the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. LA teachers are back in school, but debate over some of the reasons they went on strike goes on. We'll hear how issues such as funding for public schools and the growth of charters now heads to Sacramento. Plus, if LA's big fancy art museums feel intellectually intimidating, we have the perfect cure.
The art world is such an elitist place, and yet something like the LA Art Show is really where everybody is welcome.
It's all coming up on Take Two. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Good afternoon. That's right. It's the second day of Take Two at Two. This is going to be the only day I get to say second day of Take Two at Two, so please forgive me for that. All right, we got a packed show today. A little later, we'll head to the neighborhood of El Sereno, where the neighborhood where the debate over gentrification is heating up.
There is anger. They feel like people have superficial reasons for being here, and they're changing kind of the DNA of the neighborhood.
That story is coming up. First, though, what a difference a day makes. If you were outside Luther Burbank Middle School in Highland Park early yesterday morning, you might have heard this.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
But today, yeah, nothing. Teachers are back at the classroom. Students back in school. Morning announcements echo in the streets. And just a few blocks away at Garvanza Elementary School, parents walking their kids to the gate react to the deal reached yesterday between LA Unified and the union representing its teachers.
I'm happy that all of the teachers, the union, and the school district were able to mediate the situation, even though I know it was difficult on both sides.
Alyssa Haggis has a preschool-age son with special needs. It's his first day back since the strike. Class size, a major sticking point in negotiations, had concerned her.
With a special needs son in school, it's especially important that he has a teacher and an aide and the resources he needs in order to be supported in school.
The new agreement calls for a reduction in class size that will take place gradually over 3 years by at least one student per year, a decrease that some have said is not enough. Here's mom Tracy McNabb Hyde.
I'm not happy with the reduction of classroom. But that's going to be a hard thing to fix, knowing of all the people keep coming in to the country and California. I wish, and maybe my school is the only problem, but I wish that some sort of better security was on the table as well.
Valerie Marquez has three kids in the school, and she's just happy they're back in class. Despite the inconvenience of the last week, she was behind the teachers 100%.
We were striking with our teachers since day one, yeah. Rain, pouring, sun, whatever, we were out there with them.
Some specifics about the deal still need to be worked out, but for this busy block, it's back to normal after the first LA teacher strike in nearly 30 years. All right, now to what's next. When the deal between United Teachers Los Angeles and LAUSD was unveiled yesterday, the union announced that LA's school board would vote this month on a resolution that calls for the governor and the legislature to put a cap on new charter schools. Charter schools have faced scrutiny from members of the teachers' union. For his part, Governor Gavin Newsom has pledged to push legislation to increase accountability for the state's 1,200 charters. Let's get some reaction on that from Kelly Gomez. She's a member of the LAUSD Board of Education. Thank you very much for making the time.
Happy to be here.
All right, your reaction to this resolution.
Well, I think there's a real question at this time. The Charter Schools Act passed in 1992, and we're now living 25 years plus since it passed. And I think there's a question about where are we? Should we do a step back now and see what do the next 25 years look like in education policy in California, and what role do charter schools play? And so I'm looking forward to that conversation.
So you're looking forward to the resolution? You think it's necessary right now?
You know, I wouldn't say that. Well, first, I have to say I haven't received those materials yet, and
okay.
I haven't seen the language of the resolution. And of course, with something like this, the language matters a lot. So I can't say that exactly until I see the full resolution. But I think that there is a value to studying the impact of charters over the past 25 years on student learning, on school districts, and on a range of other factors. So I hope it includes that as well.
Now, the union has blamed charter schools for distress within LAUSD, decreasing enrollment for one thing. Is that criticism warranted in your view?
You know, it's pretty complicated. I think that the main issue that's affected our district's financial status is really that California has fallen well behind other states in per pupil funding. We know we're currently 43rd in the nation when it comes to per pupil spending, and that's while we're trying to serve really high needs kids who are English learners and homeless students and kids in foster care. So we're really working, we're trying to do more with even less. And we also have other fixed costs that are really exacerbating that issue. And we do have declining enrollment, but that's due to a number of factors like the rising cost of housing in LA, declining birth rates, and charter schools in part. It's more factors than just one.
Now, you were a teacher before you became a board member. You spent much of that time at charter schools. You were supported by many in the pro-charter camp when you ran for the school board. How do you even measure a successful charter school over one that, say, needs to improve?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a complicated task, but we are actually already undertaking that work here in LAUSD. Last year, I wrote a resolution that is going to create a school performance framework. Basically, it's going to be a set of criteria that measures success across all school models. And it will look at not just academics, which is really where the law has focused with regard to charter schools, but other factors like socio-emotional learning, family engagement, parent engagement, student engagement, to really look at, you know, across the whole range of things that we think are important when it comes to school success, how are charters doing, and really to be more holistic rather than just looking at test scores like has been the approach in the past.
Is transparency an issue for charter schools right now?
You know, I think across the state, there are certainly some issues with transparency. And I think, of course, you know, while there are a lot of good charter operators that are operating in California, you know, you hear about the bad ones. And I think, you know, we need to legislate to make sure fewer bad operators can exist. In LA Unified, we actually have stricter standards for transparency than other districts do. And that's why we're actually looked at as a model charter authorizer in the state, because we have those stricter standards for transparency.
I'm talking to Kelly Gonez, member of the LAUSD Board of Education. Now, many saw the race for superintendent of public instruction as a kind of a proxy war between advocates of charter schools and the teachers union. Tony Thurman won that election, and he's called for a pause on new charters while the state examines the effects, financial effects they might have had on districts. Is that the best step forward in your view?
I mean, I think Superintendent Thurman's idea has some reason behind it and some merit to it. And, you know, I believe that there's room for a thoughtful conversation on the right number of schools of any type in a particular community. And I believe that at some point, opening more schools continuously will hurt all students because the existing schools won't be sustainable and won't have the resources they need to really provide high quality options to those kids. And that's true for both district schools and charter schools. So I'm absolutely, I think as Superintendent Thurman has proposed, I'm open to looking at that balance and identifying the right policy approach for our current day.
But would it be wise to put a pause on it so this can be examined a little bit further?
I'm not sure a pause is the right approach exactly, but I think he's hitting on an important issue, and I think we're going to start that conversation here in L.A. shortly when we consider that resolution.
Now, the school board will vote on that resolution, whether to push lawmakers to put a cap on charters. I'm wondering, will you vote for that?
You know, I don't support a cap in particular as a policy approach because I think it's an arbitrary limit on schools that isn't based on what's best for students. But like I said, I'm open to other options that would help get at the same goal. And so I'm looking forward to that conversation, looking forward to reading the resolution.
All right. Kelly Gonez is a member of the LAUSD Board of Education. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, now to something completely different. The LA Art Show opens tonight. This massive event takes over the LA Convention Center in downtown, where tens of thousands of artists and art lovers will gather. Some will display, some will just look, while others will spend a whole lot of money to buy pieces for their own collections. Now, the show started from humble beginnings just a few decades ago, and it's grown to become one of the hottest events in the art world. To find out why, I met up with Matt Gleason this morning. He's an art curator and the owner of the gallery Coagula Curatorial in Chinatown. And he started off our conversation with the reasons the LA Art Show is such a draw.
It's huge, for one. If you want to get a lot of art in one day, I mean, to drive around to go to gallery in this town would be the gas, or taking an Uber is going to break you, you know. Come to the fair, it's a decent admission price, and you will be satiated with art by the time you leave here. There's a lot of it.
All right, Matt, take us inside. Let's see what we're going
to
see.
There's a lot to see.
Awesome. All right, Matt, so we're walking inside. People are still setting up, Matt, so we're going to be hearing probably some hammers and some people working. But tonight, is tonight the night where everything has to be all set up by?
Tonight's the VIP night. The celebrities are coming out. The big collectors come out tonight. It's the one night where the money shows up to the art world.
All right, so what are we looking at?
This is a great section called Littletopia. And this is the pop surrealist movement is definitely always a big deal at the LA Art Show.
Pop surrealism, what is it?
Popular images that are easily accessible, and yet there's something weird about them. So this is a site-specific installation by the duo Dose House, and they find cardboard in alleys that they make into different things. And here they've done the entryway to Littletopia.
So what it looks like, you're looking right at a theater. You've got a hand holding marionette strings. There is an actual puppet to the side that looks
like
it's being...
Puppet.
Yeah, life-size puppet, actually taller than probably any human being. And it is black and gray.
Those are their signature
the
colors, okay. Black, white, yeah. And gray. And within that structure, Doss House has carved a great career for themselves.
Matt, why'd you decide to take us here first?
Well, Doss House is pretty hot. And one of the things about the LA Art Show is they've really made sure to privilege pop surrealism and give them this Littletopia section every year. A lot of people look down on realistic painting in an era of abstraction, and a lot of art fairs would turn their nose up at this as being too pedestrian. But when you look at the talent and the actual application in it, there's way more imagination in two artworks here than in a lot. You could go to some art fairs that are really heavily curated and everything looks the same, and you're never going to see the talent that pop surrealism delivers.
All right, what can we see next?
I think we should just see like the standard like art world art, you know.
Standard art world art. Okay, let's go take a look.
These are, Andy Warhol did a lot of prints. Those were really the bread and butter of the operation back in the day.
Beautiful colors. Yeah. Flowers. It's four flowers on a square box.
His flower series is very popular, very popular. Wow. And there's lots of Warhols in the fair. This is not the only booth. I mean, there's lots to see. But this is, you know, you have to have... what they call blue chip art that attracts the big collectors that maybe they don't have a Warhol in their collection yet. You know, they need to fill it out. They come for the big names, but they discover a lot of emerging artists along the way too.
What does the LA Art Show do for artists? Is it one of these things where it is a huge deal that could really make or break them?
You know, a big collector coming here, buying art, a curator from a museum, for example, buying somebody's art, that's a make or break moment. The interesting part about the purchase process is if they turn left, they make your career. If they turn right, they never even see your booth. You know, it's so huge. You could be here all day and still miss huge chunks of the art here.
What does this show say about LA's role in a global art community?
Second to New York, LA could say certainly that it's the number two art market in the world. Probably Hong Kong.
In the world?
Oh, yeah. Hong Kong and London would probably argue with you there. But there's a lot of evidence that LA has a lot of galleries, a lot of commercial activity, but it is also home to so much art production. And there's an endless supply of galleries.
We're at the LA Art Show with curator Matt Gleason. Matt, this show started a long time ago, Pasadena Civic Center, about 25 years ago.
Oh, yeah, many years
ago. It struggled to be taken seriously. What happened over the course of time that elevated this show to the standing it has now in the world?
It's grown along with L.A. You know, L.A. was a backwater of art, and now it's seen as really central.
A backwater of art.
Yeah, absolutely. It was New York looks down its nose on everything, and it especially looked down on Los Angeles. The art world is an old boys club. You gotta pay your dues to get in, or you gotta have a lot of money to pay the dues with, you know. So anybody starting anything in the art world is always looked at a little suspect, like, are you gonna be around? Do you have staying power?
So how is it seen in the global art world now, the LA Art Show?
The LA Art Show is kind of like an upper middle class fair. You've got some very elite fairs. You have Art Basel, Miami Beach, Hong Kong, and Basel, Switzerland. And that's like the top of the pyramid. Here, the LA Art Show is like upper middle class. You can really get in and meet people. I mean, the VIP reception at Art Basel is like a billionaire's convention. The VIP reception tonight at the LA Art Show will be a millionaire's convention.
Okay, so LACMA is one of the several museums that take part in the LA Art Show. What other institutions are involved and what role do they play here?
Look, LACMA, LA County Museum, we are LA County, so this is our museum. For that to participate really signals that the LA Art Show wants to have a dialogue with Southern California. It is not one of these elite art fairs that's like, oh, if you're not a billionaire, you know, fine, we'll let you look at the art and please get out of my face, you know, that sort of thing. I'm gung-ho on LACMA being here.
All right, so Matt, say someone's listening, plans to come this weekend to see the LA Art Show. What kind of trends are you seeing that maybe someone could notice as they're walking through these hallways?
Oh, well, I can tell you that after walking around, I'm a little sick of pop art. I mean, I thought, you know, it should have, you know, it was great in the 60s, but, you know, it's like, almost, you know, folk music was great in the 60s, and the radio isn't really full of that. So there may be a little too much pop art, but with this pop surrealism, at least they're making this attempt to kind of keep it current and keep it imaginative. So there's a great contrast between the people who are just trying to imitate Warhol to make a quick sale and the pop surrealists who are really taking, like, ideas of popular culture and pushing them further.
That's art curator Matt Gleason. He's also the owner of Coagula Curatorial in Chinatown. Matt, thank you very much for taking us out on a tour of the LA Art Show.
Oh, thanks. It was a blast. Come on down this weekend, guys.
So you heard there, I got to get a sneak preview of the LA Art Show. It is pretty darn cool and wasn't even put together yet. If you are heading down to the Convention Center for the LA Art Show, please, please send us some pictures. Find us on Instagram, Take Two Show. That's Take Two Show. You can find me on Instagram as well, A Martinez LA. That's A Martinez LA. All right. Now, in a big city like LA, things change all the time. The downtown skyline, a lot different now than it was when I was a kid in the 80s. Neighborhood demographics also change. They shift or even gentrify. Now, it's one of the most controversial and divisive issues our city faces. We'll go to one LA neighborhood where that battle is being waged right now. That's ahead when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The annual homeless count is underway in many Southern California counties this week. Yesterday, we heard what was happening on the ground in Los Angeles and in Ventura. Now we turn to Orange County. KPCC's Jill Replegal was out on the streets with volunteers early this morning. Jill, I know it's been a long day for you, so thank you very much for joining us.
It has. Now, no problem.
Jill, what was it like out there this morning? How does the counting actually work?
Yeah, so Orange County is using an app this year, a survey app. And so all of the volunteers were asked to download that before we started. We met at a deployment center, and I went to San Juan Capistrano, so it was for South Orange County. And then they loaded the surveys onto our phones. And so we went out with the surveys preloaded on our phones. We all had maps. I went to sort of downtown San Juan Capistrano with a small group. We walked around to some kind of hot spots where homeless individuals are known to either sleep or, you know, congregate in cars. Yeah. And so we walked around and talked to people.
And that's awesome. A high-tech count with the app and everything. That's awesome. Now, the whole goal of the count is, of course,
yeah,
to get the most up-to-date data.
And then, you know, we would finish a survey.
Yeah.
Right, right. Sorry, I was just going to say, you know, as soon as we finished a survey, we would, you know, click submit and it would go straight into the database.
That's cool. That's really cool. Hopefully that makes everything a lot more accurate. And you got a glimpse this morning of some of the numbers so far. Tell us about some of those numbers.
Yeah. So when I got back to the deployment center, I mean, the numbers are actually coming in in real time from people, you know, pushing that submit button all over the county, yeah. all the volunteers. And so there was a big projector up and you can actually see the number ticking up and you could look at a map of where people were doing surveys. And so it was just a really kind of interesting way to look at homelessness in the county and really sort of see it spatially, at least for that first count. There's a whole nother group of volunteers going yeah. out this evening and also again tomorrow.
But it feels like it's a kind of real time count in a way, right? Like it's happening in the moment.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, we will have preliminary numbers when they're finished tomorrow. You know, they need to go back and make sure that there are no duplicates, and then they'll be doing some analysis on the information they got, and that all gets submitted to the federal government in April. But we'll have, you know, a preliminary idea very soon.
Now, having discussed both the LA and Ventura homeless counts this week, one thing that stands out is that the homeless are not always where you look. Some aren't living on the street, for example. It makes it very hard to get that accurate number. Was that something you witnessed when you were out there this morning?
Definitely. So for one thing, the county authorities really wanted to get an accurate count of families this year. So that is something that organizations that specifically work with families are taking care of, because families are harder to find on the streets. But just in my experience, I mean, I talked to one volunteer, Gary Walsh, who was out counting homeless individuals in Dana Point, and his experience illustrates the difficulty of getting an accurate count.
Most of the people that we were trying to contact are somewhat hidden. They're off the beaten path. We couldn't find where they were and couldn't find access to them, because quite often it's, you know, between buildings down a side, you know, kind of thing. And again, it was dark.
So Gary and his group ended up running into a sheriff's deputy who, you know, led them to a bunch of people that they wouldn't have found otherwise. And, you know, another way that people can get missed is people sleeping in their cars. I mean, it's, you know, it's dark out. We weren't going around knocking on windows or shining flashlights into cars. So it's an easy way to, you know, to miss a lot of people who might be out there sleeping on the streets.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that. Kaylee Wells yesterday in Ventura was talking about how deputies have an eye for this. They know exactly where to look. So they were actually helping point out people as well. KPCC Orange County reporter Jill Replicle on the current homeless count underway now in Orange County. Jill, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, now to a different kind of housing story. The El Sereno neighborhood on the east side of L.A. isn't that well known to a lot of Angelenos, but some recent tensions there are making headlines. Since October, people have reported graffiti on their homes, actually specifically the vertical wood fences of recently remodeled properties. The graffiti on these so-called hipster fences has been described as anti-gentrification, with off-color messages that I can't say out loud on the radio. Reporter Nadra Little has been living in El Sereno for about 7 years. She's been writing about the tagging and what's behind it. And we met up by one of the houses that recently had been marked with graffiti.
So we are in the 5300 block of Templeton Street, where a flipped house in El Sereno was tagged with anti-gentrification graffiti, and two other homes further down the block also were hit with the same graffiti. And my understanding is that they were hit not only in January, but also in October of last year.
So we're standing in front of one of these fences right now, and there's some profane language right on the fence. Before we get into all that, what's the neighborhood like?
Well, it's a historic neighborhood, first of all. It's one of the oldest neighborhoods in LA, and it's gone through kind of many different incarnations over the years. But there used to be a large Italian population that lived here, kind of other white ethnic groups. Like, the same thing happened in Boyle Heights and yeah. other neighborhoods around here. But now it's mostly Latino, mostly working class. We're sandwiched in between Alhambra, is heavily Chinese, and then also South Pasadena.
So in the 7 years since you moved here in 2012, what kinds of changes have you noticed?
So I definitely have noticed lots of flipped houses. I've noticed newly built houses as well. When I came here, I don't think there was any new construction, and now the neighborhood is peppered in the hills with new construction. And we're seeing homes here going for more than $1 million.
What do you think accounts for these homes, number one, the new construction being flipped so fast, and for the prices going up? What do you think accounts for that?
I mean, I think this is happening all over Los Angeles. My husband and I know some people who've had to leave, who've had to go to the Inland Empire, Antelope Valley, places like that, because they could not afford a home here.
Have you noticed that sparking any anger or hurt feelings with people in this neighborhood?
Obviously, in the larger community with groups like El Sereno Against Gentrification, there is anger that the neighborhood is changing, that people are moving here because they want to be close to downtown, issues like that. They feel like people have superficial reasons for being here and they're changing kind of the DNA of the neighborhood. At the same time, I've interviewed people who've lived here for generations and they welcome gentrification. They think it's a good thing. They want to see the neighborhood change. So I wouldn't say any one group speaks for everyone here. There does seem to be, for the longtime residents, people on both sides of the coin. I wouldn't say there's a consensus about that.
But the anger, I mean, we're seeing it right in front of us, that phrase on this wood slat fence. Wondering if there's a tension in this neighborhood that maybe is more palpable now than when you moved in 2012.
I don't remember if this group existed, if El Sereno Against Gentrification existed when I first moved in. I'm not sure what their start date was. If they did exist, I wasn't aware of their activism. However, I knew that there were similar groups right in Highland Park, Boyle Heights, etc. And I know that the sentiment of some of the anti-gentrification activists here was that they didn't want this neighborhood to become the next Highland Park. They didn't want what was happening in Boyle Heights to happen here. And I think they were especially inspired by Defend Boyle Heights, a similar group. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where this graffiti comes from, is kind of, you know, making a very public statement that if you're new to the neighborhood, if you're moving into a flipped house, they consider it, well, I've heard it referred to as like colonialism. That's what some people are saying.
How do you feel about it? You live in the area.
I mean, I guess I understand the hurt feelings. One thing that I did ask the gentrification group is, it seems like there are many factors that are leading to what's going on in this neighborhood. And I feel like they're not even all local. I think there's national factors. We have to look back to 10 years ago during the financial collapse, the subprime loans, like how all of those things affected the housing market and how we've seen not only rents, but housing prices go up. So I think that that's led to what we see in neighborhoods like this, but I wouldn't necessarily blame it on an individual who, you know, happened to see a house that they liked and moved here. I think there's so many different factors, and you could say it comes from the banks to the federal government on down.
Is it partially a race thing in that, for the most part, when we see stories of gentrification, it's usually a white family moving into a neighborhood that isn't white?
I think people feel that white families are being targeted, but I feel like LA is a very multicultural city. It's more complicated than that. It's not necessarily Latinos versus white people. I'm black, for example. I moved to the neighborhood in 2012. So while people like to think of gentrification in those ways, but I've heard other people say they don't care if the newcomers are people of color. They don't care if they're other Latinos, because they say, you know, it's gentrification when it's Latinos doing it.
So how do we begin to fix things? I mean, not necessarily fix things, but how about just arrive at a situation where there's not so much tension living in a neighborhood just because of certain factors involved in buying and selling homes?
I don't know if those tensions are ever going to go away. One of the graffiti left at another house says, "Your house raises our rent." So they're concerned that these houses are raising rent. I don't have any evidence that that's actually happening here yet, that rent prices are going up. But because of that concern, there's going to be tension.
What about the thought that this is America, there's a house for sale, I've got the money, I'm going to buy it? And it's just that simple. Is that too limited and too narrow of a view?
No, I mean, I think a lot of people, if you look at the comments on Nextdoor, a lot of people do feel like that. A lot of people are saying, you can't tell me I don't have the right to move here. I can move wherever I want. So I don't think that's going to go away. And people who don't live here, who buy a home here, may not even know, right, that these tensions exist until they move here. So I think one of the only things people can do is try to invest in the neighborhood, whether that's supporting local businesses, helping when there are kind of causes around gentrification, what can be done to try to preserve some of the spaces, some of the homes here, things like that, talking to city officials about these issues.
Nadra Niddle is a journalist who's been writing about El Sereno. Nadra, thanks for having us out here.
Thank you.
You all know how expensive paying for college can be, especially if you have to do it all by yourself. Well, there might be a new option on the table if you're a UC or CSU student. See, here's how it goes. You get some cash up front. Then, after you graduate, you share your income with your alma mater. Income sharing agreements. The pros, the cons, and the why when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm E. Martinez. Under a new bill introduced in the State Assembly, the University of California and California State University Systems would each develop pilot programs for so-called Income Share Agreements, or ISAs. Now, the arrangement would give students the option of paying for college by sharing their future incomes with their schools after graduation. For more on how these programs work, we have Jessica Thompson. She's Director of Policy and Planning at the Nonprofit Institute for College Access and Success. Jessica, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. This might be a new concept for a lot of people. So explain for us what exactly is an income share agreement or an ISA?
Essentially, an income share agreement is a contract that would be formed with a student where the investor can be different. But essentially, you make a contract with somebody who agrees to front a certain amount of your college costs up front in exchange for a future financial obligation that would require you to pay a set percentage of your income over a set number of years after you finish the education. So you could have a contract that says, you know, you're going to pay 8.5% of your income for 6 years, starting 6 months after you are no longer enrolled in school, and you know, you won't start paying until you make at least $20,000 a year. One of the key differences between a federal student loan and an ISA is that with a federal student loan, the same terms are offered to every student, regardless of their background, regardless of their major choice or their school choice.
And that's what I was going to ask you about. What's the difference between that and just any old student loan? But I guess, yeah, there are differences. Now, income share agreements are not very common. They do exist in some places. Where are they being used right now?
So they're specifically popping up in a few circumstances. We see them popping up as a solution for students who currently have no access to federal student loans. So that could be those in short-term programs or unaccredited programs like coding boot camps. There are a couple of cases where they're being used for undocumented students or international students who don't qualify for federal student loans. And we've seen them crop up at small liberal arts colleges, actually, where students are not able to meet what are pretty high costs, even after maximizing their federal student loans. There is one exception, which is a sort of a popular Purdue pilot, which targets juniors and seniors. However, their program is really designed to be layered on top of a student's federal loans as a substitute for private loans.
Talking to Jessica Thompson, she's Director of Policy and Planning at the Nonprofit Institute for College Access and Success, talking about income share agreements. Jessica, what's the thought behind these income share agreements? Is it one of those things where maybe you try to align the school and the student to make sure their education pays off?
I think with widespread attention to growing student debt levels and the effects that it has on students themselves and the economy, right, we're not surprised that people are looking for some other model for how we can finance higher education. And I think, and we're also struggling to figure out how to hold institutions accountable for good outcomes for those students. However, I think there's a lot of unintended consequences there because we know, you know, to only attempt to align that based on maximizing income after the student completes the education creates a strange set of incentives for the institution in terms of the types of programs they offer, the types of students that they admit, that frankly, again, may not be in the public interest or for the public good.
What would you say, Jessica, are the positives of income sharing as a way to pay for college expenses?
There is no interest rate. Hmm. And I think that's that is something that is really important to think about, because what we see is that when students, even if they are going to have forgiveness of some of that debt and not pay the interest, there's a significant anxiety and stress and burden that comes from looking at that balance growing instead of getting smaller. So I think that there is a significant psychological potential benefit from the idea of not having an interest rate and not seeing a balance grow and get higher even as you're sort of in good standing and making payments based on your income.
Now, on the other side, what are potential issues with these kinds of programs?
So first, speaking to this bill specifically, UC and CSU graduates face one of the lowest average debt levels in the country, and they also already have access to income-driven repayment for their federal student loans that already protects a basic amount of their income. It provides income-based payments adjusted for their family size, and it offers forgiveness of any remaining debt after a set period of time. So ISAs for UC or CSU students really feels like a solution in search of a problem. More broadly, looking at ISAs for other contexts, the lack of predictability of monthly and annual total costs for an ISA agreement is troubling. You know, with a federal student loan, you can make income-based payments, but you also have like a principal loan amount, so you know that you have a cap on how much you're going to pay.
Jessica Thompson is Director of Policy and Planning at the Nonprofit Institute for College Access and Success. We've been talking about income share agreements. Jessica, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Assemblyman Randy Vopel introduced the income share bill. He represents the 71st District in Riverside and San Diego counties. We asked him why he thinks income share agreements are a good idea for Cal State and UC schools.
It's another way to finance a college education. With this one, it's not a loan, so you're not cranking up a bunch of interest. And a kid can graduate from college, get a good job, especially if they take the right courses, and make a gazillion dollars in Silicon Valley. So they have an exact payment scale. If they're making more money than what they thought they would make, they can pay it off faster. If they're making less than $20,000 a year, then they don't have to do the income share agreement immediately. So it's got a lot of flexibility for people.
So you see this as just another option for students, opposed to maybe a replacement for the way it's been done before?
Absolutely. It won't fit everyone. And this is a pilot program that we're going to ask the UC and CSU system to voluntarily try out. And of course, nothing in California works the way it does in the rest of the United States. We're innovators, so the income share agreement will metamorphize into who knows what. I think it's kind of exciting.
Assemblyman, when you mentioned how it's not for everyone, are there specific groups of students that you envision this could help the most?
No, there will be certain groups of students that I have no idea that this may attract. It's like customers in 7-Eleven. You don't know who's coming in and who wants what kind of coffee.
We're talking to California Assemblyman Randy Vopel. He represents the 71st District in Riverside and San Diego counties. Wondering, Assemblyman, what your response is to what Jessica brought up, that UC and Cal State students don't have enough debt to even need this option to pay for school. She termed it a solution in search of a problem.
I disagree with that. The average student in California graduates with $22,000 in debt. So I think we've found the problem.
Now, some details of the ISA programs will be left for the colleges to decide, but there are a few specific rules in this bill. Can you walk us through those and why you chose them?
What will happen is a kid will sign up for it, agree to a certain percentage of future paycheck, generally within a minimum of 10 years. They can pay it off faster anyway. And it allows the person to graduate from college with zero debt on the books. He or she is not making interest payments.
What protections exist, though, for the schools? So just say in case the student doesn't finish school or decides just to drop out, but still got the money to pay for the expenses while they were there.
If you default, it's like any contract. You're going to owe whoever lent you the money somewhere down the road.
Assemblyman, what do you think the chances are for this thing going through?
I'm not quite sure. Last year, it was killed in Senate appropriations because they didn't want to spend the $600,000 on a pilot program to get it going. So we'll see what mood they're in this year when we're sitting on a gazillion dollars of surplus money.
All right. Randy Vopel represents the 71st District in Riverside and San Diego counties. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate you having me.
And we reached out to Cal State and the University of California for their thoughts on the bill. Both said they were still reviewing the legislation and declined to comment at this time. All right, one of the best things about our new time slot, Take Two at Two, by the way, is that we're going to scour the city for food, food that really tells the story of L.A. Next week, a soul food spot near Pico and Fairfax that bucks tradition. But next, get your car a lube job by day, then stuff your face with burgers at night, all in the same place. Find out where when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The Owens Valley in Eastern California has been in conflict with the city of Los Angeles for more than a century over water rights, specifically the diversion of water from the Owens River to L.A. residents 180 miles away.
Either you bring the water to L.A. or you bring L.A. to the water.
How are you going to do that?
By incorporating the valley into the city.
That's a clip from the classic 1974 film Chinatown, which chronicled a long-running dispute. But now, in what looks like a peacemaking move, the L.A. Department of Water and Power says it will relinquish the commercial properties it owns there and sell the land to the communities along Highway 395. To understand more about the significance of LADWP's move, we have John Christensen. He's a professor with the UCLA Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. John, welcome back.
Thanks, eh?
Now, it's been a long and sordid story back there. The date's, more than a century. But give us the Cliff Notes version of LADWP's involvement with Owens Valley.
Well, it's great that you played that clip from Chinatown because, you know, that really captures the myth of LA's original sin of going to the Owens Valley, acquiring the properties there and the water rights that were part of those properties, and then building a long pipeline, as you said, 180 miles to bring water to Los Angeles from the Eastern Sierra. And those taps were, you know, famously opened in 1913 when William Mulholland, the chief engineer of the city, looked at the water gushing down into the San Fernando Valley and said, there it is, yeah. Take it.
Yeah. And we muscled our way into that thing, right? I mean, it's not like we kind of asked nicely.
Well, it's a complicated history. I mean, those properties were purchased. There is some of the kind of spirit of Chinatown that gets at a greater truth of how that happened, but a lot of what is actually in the movie in terms of, you know, the trickery and fraud and so, you know, and force, you know, there's not that much evidence for that. But, you know, that said, the city did go in and quietly purchase up to around 90% of the private land in Inyo County.
And briefly, John, what have been the long-lasting consequences of LA diverting so much Owens Valley water?
Well, I mean, Owens Valley Lake dried up. There's now, often toxic dust clouds that blow up from that dry valley and, you know, cause real health or respiratory problems. The Owens River lacked water for a very long time. There's more coming back to it now. Mono Lake dropped dramatically before a court case that reaffirmed the public trust to protect natural resources, made the state protect that and, you know, ensure that enough water gets into the lake so that it can survive. And then about 10% of the private land actually in private hands and L.A. Owning the rest of it, it has really kind of foreclosed opportunities for businesses and development in the Owens Valley. And, you know, ironically has kept the valley open and preserved in a way that it probably would not have been if all of that private property had been developable. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons why Owens Valley in the Eastern Sierra is one of the most beautiful places in the world. And ironically, the fact that L.A. took all that water is one of them.
Now, to be clear, and this makes me wonder, LADWP is not giving up its water rights in the area, just the property rights. So then I'm wondering, John, how significant is this really for the people of Owens Valley?
Well, I think it is very significant.
Or symbolic,
maybe. They wanted to be able to control their destiny more for a very long time. And, you know, there's been a real thorn in their side that they couldn't even own the land under their businesses, that they couldn't, you know, develop them and realize the benefits of that. So, you know, I think it is a significant change, and it's an overture to, you know, redress some of that original sin and take responsibility for LA's history and future and how closely linked it is to the Owens Valley.
John Christensen is a professor at the UCLA Institute of the Environment and Sustainability, speaking to us about LADWP's proposal to give up its commercial properties in the Owens Valley. John, thank you very much.
You bet.
All right, in closing today, we turn to our favorite topic, food. By day, Gabriel's Automotive in Pasadena is a repair shop, changing oil, fixing tires, just a few blocks off the 210 freeway. But by night, the power tools are put away and the propane grills come out for a burger pop-up known as Smoshtown. LA's food writer Alina Shatkin didn't hesitate to sample the patties at the Smog Check station while visiting last week.
I'm excited by this menu. I'm just looking at it now. We have the Smoshtown Classic. Raw onions, all right, I like it. Cheese, pickles, ketchup, sounds like a very classic burger. And then we got one with grilled onions inside Wagyu beef. You know, being the completist I am, I think I'm gonna have to try both. Why not? We're gonna get one regular Smoshtown burger. And we're gonna get raw onions. Yes, please.
Everything on that for you?
Hell yes.
You got it.
What's your name, by the way?
I'm Lena Kajajian.
And what time do you open up?
7 p.m. The grills are on.
And you're open until?
Midnight or sellout, whichever comes first. So usually we sell out.
What's your busiest night?
Fridays and Saturdays.
Who is running this? What inspired this?
My son. He's loves to cook, and he's been wanting to do this for a long time.
There you go. That's what we want to hear. That's what we want to hear.
Do me a favor. Tell me your name.
Ohan Kejejian.
Tell me what you're doing here.
Cooking the best burgers in Pasadena possible. Hear the sizzle? We make smosh burgers here. We made our own word up. It's a smosh burger out of here. But the style burger is the smash burger.
What he does is he takes a round ball of ground beef, he puts them on the grill, and then he takes a big flat spatula, a metal one, and presses the meat down super, super thin. So it's really thin like a pancake, and not just a regular pancake, like as thin as a Swedish pancake. So that's what makes them so thin. It gives them so much surface area and makes them really crisp. And each burger has two of those really thin, crisp patties in it.
What makes it delicious is just with the love that comes in with it, man. Family, my dad helps, my best friend of years, my uncle, my little cousins, my mother on the register. All the love that we put in, that's what makes it taste so good.
Nick, Matt, Mike.
Matt.
All right, tell me your name, sir.
Mike.
Last name?
Kajajian.
And you own this auto body shop. Now, tell me, how did the burger thing come to be?
He just came out with an idea. He wants to do something like this. Pop-up burger, he wants to do something different. And he goes, can I try it and do a pop-up at the shop? I go, sure, come on, try it out, see how it works out. You're not going to lose anything, so this is where we're at right now. Yeah, if you ever need an auto repair, come by. I'll help you guys out.
Mike. Nick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like it. I can see what he means about a lot of surface area, keeping it crisp yet juicy. That's pretty crucial. I never wait in line for almost anything, but yeah, it's worth a return trip. This is Elena Shatkin. I cover Food for LAist, and this is Delicious.
And for all the details on this new burger pop-up Smoshtown, head to LAist, that's LAIST.com. All right, you know what we do right after the show? We all huddle around a laptop and just read all the tweets we get. Send us one, at Take Two, that's at Take Two. If they're fascinating and funny, we might retweet them. So find us at Take Two. Find me at A. Martinez LA. Stay tuned at 3:30 for The Frame with John Horn. That's coming up in a bit.